Most important was that of Cronos and Rhea, for it was Cronos, by reason of his bold deed, who had assumed the leadership among the gods. Of this union, Rhea gave birth to three daughters and three sons, Hestia, Demeter, and Hera, and Hades, Poseidon, and Zeus. No sooner had one of these children been born than the great Cronos swallowed each, intent that no other of the proud sons of heaven should hold kingly office among the deathless gods. The reason for eliminating his own offspring by swallowing them was a prophecy he had learned of, that strong though he was destined to be overcome by his own son. Fate was to repeat unto Cronos that which he had done unto his father. But fate could not be evaded. Wizened to the tricks of Cronos, Rhea hid her last-born son Zeus on the island of Crete. To Cronos she gave instead of the baby a great stone wrapped in swaddling clothes. Not realizing the deception, Cronos swallowed the stone, thinking it was the baby Zeus. Soon thereafter he began vomiting, disgorging one by one all the children he had previously swallowed. As the years rolled on, the strength and glorious limbs of the prince, Zeus, increased quickly. For a while, as a worthy grandson of the lusty Uranus, Zeus chased lovely goddesses, often getting into trouble with their companion gods. But then he turned his mind to affairs of state. For 10 years a war had been raging between the older Titans, the lordly Titans from high Mount Othryres, which was their abode, and the younger gods whom rich-haired Rhea bare in union with Cronos, and who settled on the opposite Mount Olympus. With bitter wrath they were fighting continually with one another at that time for 10 full years, and the hard strife had no close or end for either side, and the issue of war hung evenly balanced. Was this fighting merely the culmination of deteriorating relations between neighboring godly colonies? An outbreak of rivalry between intermingled and unfaithful gods and goddesses, where mothers slept with their sons and uncles impregnated their nieces, or the first instance of the everlasting rebellion of the young against the old regime? The Theogony does not provide a clear answer, but later Greek legends and plays suggest that all these motives combined to create a prolonged and stubborn war between the younger and the older gods. It was this ongoing war that was seen by Zeus as his chance to seize the lordship over the gods and thereby, knowingly or unknowingly, fulfill the destiny to which his father Cronos had been fated by deposing him. As his first step, Zeus set free from their deadly bonds the brothers of his father, sons of Uranus, whom his father in his foolishness had bound. In gratitude, the three Cyclopes gave him the divine weapons Gea had hidden away from Uranus, the thunder, and the radiating thunderbolt, and the lightning. They also gave Hades a magic helmet, which made its wearer invisible, and Poseidon received a magical trident, which could make the earth and sea shake. To refresh the Hecatoncheires, after their long captivity and return their vigor to them, Zeus provided the trio with nectar and ambrosia, the same that the gods eat. Then he addressed them and said, "Hear me, O bright children of Uranus and Gea, that I may say what my heart within bids me. A long while now have we, who are sprung from Cronos and the Titan gods, fought with each other every day, to get victory and to prevail. Would you now show your great might and strength, and face the Titans and the bitter strife?" And Cottus, one of the hundred-armed, answered him and said, "Divine one, you speak that which we know well. Through your devising we are come back from the murky gloom and from our merciless bonds. And so now, with fixed purpose and deliberate counsel, we will aid your power in the dreadful strife, and fight against the Titans in hard battle." So all that were born of Cronos, together with those dreaded mighty ones of overwhelming strength whom Zeus brought up to light, they all, both male and female, stirred up the hated battle that day. Arrayed against these Olympians were the older Titans, who also eagerly strengthened their ranks. As the battle was joined, it ranged all over the earth, and in the skies. The boundless sea rang terribly around, and the earth crashed loudly. Wide heaven was shaken and groaned, and high Olympus reeled from its foundations under the charge of the undying gods. From the deep sound of the gods' feet and the fearful onset of their hard missiles, the heavy quaking reached even far Tartarus. In a verse reminiscent of the Dead Sea Scroll text, the Theogony recalled the war cries of the battling gods. Thus, then, they launched their grievous bolts at one another, and the cry of both armies, as they shouted, reached to the starry heaven, as they clashed with a great battle cry. Zeus himself was fighting with all his might, using his divine weapons to the utmost. From the skies, opposite Mount Olympus, he came forthwith, hurling his lightning. The bolts flew thick and fast from his strong hand, thunder and lightning together whirling as an awesome flame. The fertile earth crashed around in burning, and the vast wood crackled aloud with fire all about. All the land seethed, as did the sweet water streams and the salty sea. Then Zeus hurled a thunderstone, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 13, against Mount Othiris. It was indeed nothing short of an atomic explosion. The hot vapor lapped around the Titans, of Gea born. Flame unspeakable rose bright to the upper air. The flashing glare of the thunderstone, its lightning blinded their eyes, so strong it was. Astounding heat seized chaos. It seemed as if earth and wide heaven above had come together. A mighty crash, as though earth was hurled to ruin. So great a crash was there while the gods clashed together in strife. In addition to the awesome sound, the blinding flash, and the extreme heat, the hurling of the thunderstone also created an immense windstorm. Also were the winds brought rumbling, earthquake and dust storm, thunder and lightning. All this did the thunderstone of great Zeus bring about. And when the two contending camps heard and saw what had happened, an horrible uproar of terrible strife arose. Mighty deeds were shown, and the battle inclined. The fighting was abating, for the gods had the upper hand over the Titans. Insatiated for war, the three Cyclopes set upon the Titans, overpowering them with handheld missiles. They bound them in bitter chains and hurled them into captivity to far Tartarus. There, by the counsel of Zeus, who rides the clouds, the Titan gods are hidden under misty gloom in a dank place at the ends of huge earth. The three Cyclopes stayed there, too, as trusty warders of Zeus, to watch over the imprisoned Titans. As Zeus was about to claim the Aegis, the suzerainty over all the gods, a sudden challenger appeared on the scene. For when Zeus had driven the Titans from heaven, great Gea bare her youngest child, Typhoeus, of the love of Tartarus, with the aid of golden Aphrodite. Typhoeus, Typhon, was a real monster. Strength was with his hands in all that he did. And the feet of the strong god were untiring. From his shoulders grew 100 heads of a snake, a fearful dragon, with dark flickering tongues. From under the brows of his eyes and his marvelous heads, fire flashed, and fire burned from his heads as he glared. And there were voices in all his dreadful heads, which uttered incredible sounds, the sound of a man as he speaks, and the sound of a bull, and that of a lion, and the sound of a puppy. According to Pindar and Aeschylus, Typhon was gigantic in height, and his head reached to the stars. Truly a thing past help would have happened on that day, the Muses revealed to Hesiod. It was almost inevitable that Typhoeus would have come to reign over mortals and immortals. But Zeus was quick to perceive the danger and lost no time in attacking him. The series of battles that ensued were no less awesome than the fighting between the gods and the Titans, for the snake god Typhon was equipped with wings and could fly about just as Zeus, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 14. Zeus thundered hard and mightily, and the earth around resounded terribly. as did the wide heaven above, and the sea, and the watery streams, even the nether parts of the earth. Divine weapons were again employed by both combatants. Through the two of them, through the thunder and lightning, heat engulfed the dark blue seas, and through the fire from the monster, and the scorching winds and blazing thunderbolt, the whole earth seethed, and sky and sea. Great waves raged along the beaches, and there arose an endless shaking. In the lower world, Hades trembled where he ruled. Tremble did the Titans imprisoned at the ends of earth. Chasing each other in the skies and over land, Zeus managed to be the first to achieve a direct hit with his lurid thunderbolt. The bolt burned all the marvelous heads of the monster, all that were around him, and Typhoeus crashed down to earth in his marvelous contraption. When Zeus had vanquished him and lashed him with his strokes, Typhoeus was hurled down a maimed wreck. The huge earth groaned. A flame shot forth from the stricken lord in the dim, rugged, secluded valley of the mount where he was smitten. A great part of huge earth was scorched by the terrible vapor, melting as tin melts when heated by man's art. In the glow of a blazing fire did the earth melt down. In spite of the crash and the tremendous impact of Typhon's vehicle, the god himself remained alive. According to the Theogony, Zeus cast him, too, into wide Tartarus. With his victory, his reign was secure, and he turned to the important business of procreation, bringing forth progeny by wives and concubines alike. Though the Theogony described only one battle between Zeus and Typhon, the other Greek writings assert that that was the final battle, preceded by several others in which Zeus was the first one to be hurt. Initially, Zeus fought with Typhon at close quarters, using the special sickle his mother had given him for the evil deed, for it was his purpose also to castrate Typhon. But Typhon enmeshed Zeus in his net, wrested his sickle away, and with it cut out the sinews of Zeus's hands and feet. He then deposited the helpless Zeus, his sinews, and his weapons in a cave. But the gods Aegipan and Hermes found the cave, resurrected Zeus by restoring his sinews, and returned his weapons to him. Zeus then escaped and flew back in a winged chariot to Olympus, where he acquired a new supply of bolts for his thunderer. With these, Zeus renewed the attack on Typhon, driving him to Mount Nyssa, where the fates tricked Typhon into eating the food of mortal men, whereupon he was weakened instead of being strengthened. The renewed fighting began in the skies over Mount Haemus in Thrace, continued over Mount Etna in Sicily, and ended over Mount Cassius on the Asiatic coast of the eastern Mediterranean. There Zeus, using his thunderbolt, shot Typhon down from the skies. The similarity between the battles, the weapons used, the locations, as well as the tales of castration, mutilation, and resurrection, all in the course of a struggle for succession, convinced Herodotus and other Greek classical historians that the Greeks had borrowed their theogony from the Egyptians. Aegipan stood for the African ram god of Egypt, and Hermes paralleled the god Thoth. Hesiod himself reported that when Zeus came unto the mortal beauty Alcmena, so that she might bear him the heroic Heracles, he slipped at night from Mount Olympus and went to the land of Typhonion, resting there atop the Phycian, the Sphinx Mountain, the deadly Sphinx that destroyed the Cadmeans, the ancients, which featured in the doings of Hera, the official spouse of Zeus, was also connected in these legends with Typhon and his domain. And Apollodorus reported that when Typhon was born and grew to an incredible size, the gods rushed to Egypt to take a look at the awesome monster. Most scholars have held that Mount Cassius, the site of the final battle between Zeus and Typhon, was located near the mouth of the Orontes River in today's Syria. But as Otto Eisfeld has shown in a major study, there was another mount called by that name in antiquity, a promontory on the Serbonic Sealet that juts out of the Sinai Peninsula into the Mediterranean Sea. he suggested that that was the mount referred to in the legends. Once again, all one had to do was trust the information given to Herodotus in Egypt, describing the land route from Phoenicia to Egypt via Philistia. He wrote that the Asian lands extend to Lake Serbonis, near the place where Mount Cassius juts out into the sea. Egypt begins at Lake Serbonis, where the tale goes that Typhon hid himself. Once again, Greek and Egyptian tales converged, with the Sinai Peninsula as the climax. Notwithstanding the many connecting threads the ancient Greeks had found between their theogony and that of Egypt, it was much farther away in India that 19th century European scholars have found even more amazing parallels. No sooner had Sanskrit, the language of ancient India, been mastered at the end of the 18th century, then Europe began to be enchanted by translations of hitherto unknown writings. At first, a field dominated by the British, the study of Sanskrit literature, philosophy, and mythology, was by the mid-19th century a favorite of German scholars, poets, and intellectuals. For Sanskrit turned out to be a mother tongue of the Indo-European languages, to which German belonged, and its bearers to India were migrants from the shores of the Caspian Sea, Aryans, as the Germans believed their ancestors too, to have been. Central to this literature were the Vedas, sacred scriptures believed by Hindu tradition to be not of human origin, having been composed by the gods themselves in a previous age. They were brought to the Indian subcontinent by the Aryan migrants sometime in the second millennium B.C., as oral traditions. But as time went on, more and more of the original 100,000 verses were lost. So, circa 200 BC, a sage wrote down the remaining verses, dividing them into four parts, the Rig Veda, the Veda of verses, which is made up of 10 books, the Sama Veda, the chanted Vedas, the Yajur Veda, mostly sacrificial prayers, and the Atharva Veda, spells and incantations. In time, the various components of the Vedas and the auxiliary literature that stemmed from them, the mantras, the brahmanas, the aranyakas, the Upanishads, were augmented by the non-Vedic Puranas, ancient writings, together with the great epic tales of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. They make up the sources of the Aryan and Hindu tales of heaven and earth, gods and heroes. Because of the long oral interval, the length and profusion of texts finally written down over many centuries, the many names, generic terms, and epithets employed for the deities interchangeably, and the fact that many of these original names and terms were non-Aryan after all, consistency and precision are not hallmarks of this Sanskrit literature. Yet some facts and events emerge as basic tenets of the Aryan Hindu legacy. In the beginning, these sources relate, there were only the celestial bodies, the primeval ones who flow. There was an upheaval in the heavens, and the dragon was split in two by the flowing one of storms. Calling the two parts by names of non-Aryan origin, the tales assert that Rahu, the upper part of the destroyed planet, unceasingly traverses the heavens in search of vengeance. The lower part, Ketu, the cut-off one, has joined the primeval ones in their flowing orbits. Many ages then passed, and a dynasty of gods of heaven and earth made its appearance. The heavenly Maharishi, who headed them, had 7 or 10 children by his consort, Prithivi, the broad one, who personified the earth. One of them, Kasyapa, he of the throne, made himself chief of the Devas, the shiny ones, seizing the title Dias Pitar, Sky Father, the undoubted source of the Greek title named Zeus, Dios, and its Roman parallel Jupiter, Diospiter. Quite prolific, Kasyapa begot many gods, giants, and monstrous offspring by diverse wives and concubines. Most prominent and individually known and revered since Vedic times were the Adityas, some born to Kasyapa by his consort Aditi, boundless. Numbering 7 at first, they were Vishnu, Varuna, Mitra, Rudra, Pushan, Tavashtri, and Indra. Then the Adityas were joined by Agni, a son of Kasyapa, either by his spouse Aditi, or as some texts suggest, by his own mother, Prithivi. As in the Greek Olympian circle, the number of the Adityas finally rose to 12. Among them were Bhaga, who is believed by scholars to have become the supreme Slavic god, Bog, the last one to be born by Aditi, though whether he was fathered by Kasyapa was uncertain, was Surya. Tavashtri, fashioner, in his role as all-accomplishing, the artisan of the gods, provided them with aerial cars and magical weapons. From a blazing celestial metal, he fashioned a discus for Vishnu, a trident for Rudra, a fire weapon for Agni, a bolt-hurling thunderer for Indra, and a flying mace for Surya. In ancient Hindu depictions, all these weapons appeared as handheld missiles of diverse shapes, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 15. In addition, the gods acquired other weapons from Tavashtri's assistants. Indra, for example, obtained an aerial net, with which he could snare his foes during sky battles. The celestial chariots or aerial cars were invariably described as bright and radiant, made of or plated with gold. Indra's Vimana, aerial car, had lights shining at its sides and moved swifter than thought, traversing rapidly vast distances. Its unseen steeds were sun-eyed, emitting a reddish hue, but also changing colors. In other instances, the aerial cars of the gods were described as multi-tiered. Sometimes they could not only fly in the air, but also travel underwater. In the epic tale of the Mahabharata, the arrival of the gods for a wedding feast in a fleet of aerial cars is described thus. The gods, in cloud-born chariots, came to view the scene so fair. Bright Idityas, in their splendor, Maruts, in the moving air, winged Suparnas, scaly Nagas, Devarishis, pure and high, for their music famed, Gandharvas, and fair Apsaras of the sky. Bright celestial cars in concourse sailed upon the cloudless sky. The texts also speak of the Ashvins, drivers, gods who specialized in piloting aerial chariots. Swift as young falcons they were, the best of charioteers who reached the heavens, always piloting their craft in pairs, accompanied by a navigator. Their vehicles, which sometimes appeared in groups, were golden-made, bright and radiant, with easy seat and lightly rolling. They were constructed on a triple principle, having three levels, three seats, three supporting poles, and three rotating wheels. That chariot of yours, hymn 22 of book 8 of the Rig Veda, said in praise of the Ashvins, hath a triple seat and reins of gold, the famous car that traverses heaven and earth. The rotating wheels, it appears, served diverse functions, one to raise the craft, another to give it direction, and the third to speed it along. One of your chariot's wheels is moving swiftly around. One speeds for you its onward course. As in the Greek tales, so did the gods of the Vedas display little morality or restraint in sexual matters, sometimes getting away with it, sometimes not, as when the indignant Adityas selected Rudra, the three-eyed, to kill their grandfather, Dias, for having violated their sister, Ushas. Dias, wounded, saved his life by fleeing to a distant celestial body. Also, as in the Greek tales, so did the gods, according to Hindu lore, mingle, in later times, in the loves and wars of mortal kings and heroes. In these instances, the aerial vehicles of the gods played roles even greater than their weapons. Thus, when one hero drowned, the Ashvins appeared in a fleet of three aerial chariots, self-activated watertight ships which traversed the air, dived into the ocean, retrieved the hero from the watery depths, and conveyed him over land, beyond the liquid ocean. And when there was the tale of Yayati, a king who married the daughter of a god, when the couple bore children, the happy grandfather gave the king a highly effulgent, golden celestial chariot, which could go everywhere without interruption. Without losing time, Yayati ascended the chariot, and irrepressible in battle, within 6 nights conquered the entire earth. As in the Iliad, so did Hindu traditions tell of wars of men and gods over beautiful heroines. Best known of these tales is the Ramayana, the long epic tale of Rama, the prince, whose beautiful wife was abducted by the king of Lanka, the island of Ceylon, off India. Among the gods who turned out to help Rama was Hanuman, the god with a monkey face, who conducted aerial battles with the winged Garuda, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 16, one of the monstrous offspring of Kasyapa. In another instance, Sukra, a god sullied by immorality, abducted Tara, the beautiful wife of Indra's charioteer. The illustrious Rudra and other gods then came to the aid of the aggrieved husband. There ensued a terrible battle, destructive of gods and demons, on account of Tara. In spite of their awesome weapons, the gods were bested and had to seek refuge with the prime deity. Thereupon the grandfather of the gods himself came to earth and put an end to the fighting by returning Tara to her husband. Then Tara gave birth to a son, whose beauty overclouded the celestials. Filled with suspicion, the gods demanded to know who the true father was, the lawful husband, or the abductor god. She proclaimed that the boy was the son of Soma, celestial immortality, and she named him Buddha. But all that was in times yet to come. In the olden days, the gods battled among themselves for more important causes: supremacy and rule over the earth and its resources. With so many offspring of Kasyapa, by diverse wives and concubines, as well as the descendants of the other olden gods, conflict soon became inevitable. The dominance of the Adityas was especially resented by the Asuras, elder gods whose mothers bore them to Kasyapa before the Adityas were born. Bearing a non-Aryan name of a clear Near Eastern origin, being akin to names of the supreme gods of Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt, Asher, Asur, Osiris, they eventually assumed in the Hindu traditions the role of the evil gods, the demons. Jealousy, rivalry, and other causes of friction finally led to war when the earth, which at first produced food without cultivation, succumbed to a global famine. The gods, the texts reveal, sustained their immortality by drinking soma, an ambrosiac that was brought down to earth from the celestial abode by an eagle and was drunk mixed with milk. The kine, cow cattle, of the gods also provided the gods favored sacrifices of roasted meat. But a time came when all these necessities became scarcer and scarcer. The Satapata Brahmana describes the events that followed. The gods and the Asuras, both sprung from the father of gods and men, were contending for superiority. The gods vanished, the Asuras, yet afterwards they once more harassed them. The gods and the Asuras, both of them sprung from the father of gods and men, were again contending for superiority. This time the gods were worsted, and the Asuras thought, "To us alone assuredly belongs this world." They thereupon said, "Well then, let us divide this world between ourselves, and having divided it, let us subsist thereon." Accordingly, they set about dividing it from west to east. Hearing this, the defeated Adityas went to plead for a share in earth's resources. When they heard this, the gods said, "The Asuras are actually dividing this earth. Come, let us go where the Asuras are dividing it. For what would become of us if we were to get no share of earth?" Placing Vishnu at their head, they went to the Asuras. Haughtily, the Asuras offered to give the Adityas not only as much of earth as Vishnu could lie upon, but the gods used a subterfuge and placed Vishnu in an enclosure that could walk in three directions, thereby regaining three of the earth's four regions. The outsmarted asuras were attacked from the south, and the gods asked Agni, how could they vanquish the asuras forever? Agni suggested a pincer maneuver. While the gods attack from their regions, I will go round to the northern side, and you will shut them in from here, and whilst shutting them in, we will put them down. Having so vanquished the asuras, the Satapata Brahmana records, the gods were anxious as to how they might replenish the sacrifices. Accordingly, many of the battle segments of the ancient Hindu writings deal with the recapture of the kine and the resupply of the soma beverage. These wars were fought on land, in the air, and beneath the seas. The asuras, according to the Mahabharata, made for themselves three metal fortresses in the skies, from which they attacked the three regions of the earth. Their allies in the war with the gods could become invisible and used invisible weapons, and others fought from a city beneath the sea, which they had captured from the gods. One who excelled in these battles was Indra, Storm. On land he smote 99 strongholds of the asuras, killing great numbers of their armed followers. In the skies he fought from his aerial car, the asuras, who were hiding in their cloud fortresses. Hymns in the Rig Veda list groups of gods as well as individual deities defeated by Indra. Thou slewest with thy bolt the Sasyu. Far from the floor of heaven in all directions, the ancient rightless ones fled to destruction. The Dasyu thou hast burned from the heavens. They met in fight the army of the blameless. Then the Navagavas put forth all their power. Like emasculates contending with men they fled, by steep paths from Indra they scattered. Indra broke through Elibsa's strong castles, and Shushna with his horn he cut to pieces. Thou slewest thy fighting foe with thy thunder. Fierce on his enemies fell Indra's weapon. With his sharp rushing thunderbolt he rent their towns to pieces. Thou goest forth from fight to fight intrepidly, destroying castle after castle with thy strength. Thou, Indra, with thy friend who makes the foe bow down, slowest from far away the guileful Namuchi. Thou hast struck down in death Karanja, Parnaya. Thou hast destroyed the 100 towns of Vangrida. The ridges of the lofty heaven thou madest shake when thou, daring by thyself, smote Sambara. Defeating the gods' enemies in groups as well as in single combat, and making them flee to destruction, Indra turned his efforts to the freeing of the kine. The demons hid them inside a mountain, guarded by Vala, encircler. Indra, aided by the Angirases, young gods who could emit divine flames, smashed into the fortified hideaway and freed the kine. Some scholars, as J. Herbert in Hindu mythology, hold that what Indra released or retrieved was a divine ray, not cows, for the Sanskrit word go has both meanings. When these wars of the gods began, the Adityas named Agni, Agil, as Hotri, their chief of office. As the wars progressed, some texts suggest for well over 1,000 years, Vishnu, active, was made the chief. But when the fighting was over, Indra, having contributed so much to the victory, claimed the supremacy. As in the Greek Theogony, one of his first acts to establish his claim was to slay his own father. The Rig Veda asks Indra rhetorically, Indra, who made thy mother a widow? The answer follows also as a question. What god was present in the fray when thou didst slay thy father, seizing him by the foot? For this crime Indra was excluded by the gods from the drinking of the soma, thereby endangering his continued immortality. They ascended up to heaven, leaving Indra with the kine he had retrieved. But he went up after them, with the raised thunder weapon, ascending from the northern place of the gods. Fearing his weapon, the gods shouted, "Do not hurl!" and agreed to let Indra share once again in the divine nourishments. Indra's seizing of the leadership of the gods, however, did not go unchallenged. The challenge came from Tavashtri, to whom oblique references are made in the hymns as the firstborn, a fact that may explain his own claim to the succession. Indra smote him quickly with the thunder weapon, the very weapon that Tavashtri had fashioned for him. But then the struggle was taken over by Vritra, the obstructor, whom some texts call the firstborn of Tavashtri, but whom some scholars interpret as having been an artificial monster, because he quickly grew to an immense size. At first Indra was bested, and he fled to a far corner of earth. But when all the gods then abandoned him, only the 21 Maruts stood by his side. They were a group of gods who manned the fastest aerial cars, who, loud roaring as the winds make the mountains rock and reel, as they lift themselves aloft. These verily wondrous, red of hue, speed on their course with a roar over the ridges of the sky, and spread themselves with beams of light, bright, celestial, with lightning in their hands and helmets of gold upon their heads. With the aid of the Maruts, Indra returned to battle Vritra. The hymns which describe the fight in glowing terms have been translated by J. Muir into rhyming poetic verses. The valiant god his car ascends, swept by his fervid bounding speeds. Athwart the sky the hero speeds. The Marut hosts his escort form, impetuous spirits of the storm. On flashing lightning cars they ride, and gleam in warlike pomp and pride. Like lions roar their voice of doom, with iron force their teeth consume. The hills, the earth itself, they shake, all creatures at their coming quake. While earth quaked and all creatures ran for cover, only Vritra, the foe, calmly watched their approach. Perched on a steep aerial height, shone Vritra's stately fortress bright. Upon the wall, in martial mood, the bold gigantic demon stood. Confiding in his magic arts, and armed with store of fiery darts. Without alarm, defying the might of Indra's arm, unafraid of the terrors of the deadly flight, rushing toward him, Vritra stood in wait. And then was seen a dreadful sight, when god and demon met in fight. His sharpened missiles Vritra shot, his thunderbolts and lightnings hot, he hurled as thick as rain. The god his fiercest rage defied, his blunted weapons glanced aside, at Indra launched in vain. When Vritra spent all his fiery missiles, Indra was able to take over the offensive. The lightnings then began to flash, the direful thunderbolts to crash, by Indra proudly hurled. The gods themselves with awe were stilled, and stood aghast, and terror filled the universal world. The thunderbolts hurled by Indra, forged by the master hand of Tavashtri, of divine iron, were complex, blazing missiles. Who the arrowy shower could stand, discharged by Indra's red right hand. The thunderbolts with 100 joints, the iron shafts with 1,000 points, which blaze and hiss athwart the sky, swift to their mark, unerring fly, and lay the proudest foeman low, with sudden and resistless blow, whose very sound can put to flight the fools who dare the thunderer's might. Unerringly, the guided missiles hit their target, and soon the knell of Vritra's doom was sounded by the clang and boom of Indra's iron shower. Pierced, cloven, crushed, with horrid yell, the dying demon headlong fell, down from his cloud-built tower. Fallen to the ground as trunks of trees that axe had felled, Vritra lay prostrate. But though footless and handless, still he challenged Indra. Then Indra gave him the coup de grace, and smote him with his bolt between the shoulders. Indra's victory was complete, but as fate would have it, the fruits of victory were not his alone. As he was claiming the throne of Kasyapa, his father, old doubts surfaced concerning his true parenthood. It was a fact that upon his birth his mother had hid him from Kasyapa's wrath. Why? Was there truth to the rumors that his true father was his own elder brother, Tavashtri? The Vedas lift the veil of mystery only partly. They tell, however, that Indra, great god that he was, did not rule alone. He had to share powers with Agni and Surya, his brothers, just as Zeus had to share dominions with his brothers, Hades and Poseidon. Chapter 4. The Earth Chronicles. As if the similarities of the genealogies and warfare between the Greek and Hindu gods were not enough, tablets discovered in the Hittite royal archives, at a site nowadays called Bogazkoi, contained more tales of the same story. How, as one generation waned unto the other, one god fought another for supremacy. The longest texts discovered dealt, as could be expected, with the Hittite supreme deity, Teshub. His genealogy, his rightful assumption of dominion over Earth's upper regions, and the battles launched against him by the god Kumarbi and his offspring. As in the Greek and Egyptian tales, the avenger of Kumarbi was hidden with the aid of allied gods until he grew up somewhere in a dark-hued part of Earth. The final battles raged in the skies and in the seas. In one battle, Teshub was supported by 70 gods riding in their chariots. At first defeated and either hiding or exiled, Teshub finally faced his challenger in god-to-god combat. Armed with the Thunderer Stormer, which scatters the rocks for 90 furlongs, and the lightning which flashes frightfully, he ascended skyward in his chariot, pulled by 2 gold-plated bulls of heaven, and from the skies he set his face toward his enemy. Though the fragmented tablets lack the tale's ending, it is evident that Teshub was finally victorious. Who were these ancient gods who fought each other for supremacy and sought dominion over Earth by pitting nation against nation? Fittingly, perhaps, treaties that had ended some of the very wars launched by men for their gods provide important clues. When the Egyptians and the Hittites made peace after more than 2 centuries of warfare, it was sealed by the marriage of the daughter of the Hittite king, Hattusilish III, to the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II. The pharaoh recorded the event on commemorative stela, which he placed at Karnak, at Elephantine, near Aswan, and at Abu Simbel. Describing the journey and the arrival of the princess in Egypt, the inscription relates that when His Majesty saw that she was as beautiful of face as a goddess, he at once fell in love with her, and deemed her to be something lovely granted him by the god Ptah, and a sign of Hittite acknowledgement of his victory. What all this diplomatic maneuvering had entailed was clarified by other parts of the inscription. 13 years earlier, Hattusilish had sent to the pharaoh the text of a peace treaty, but Ramses II, still brooding over his near-fatal experience in the Battle of Kadesh, ignored it. The great chief of Hatti then wrote appeasingly to His Majesty year after year, but the King Ramses paid no attention. Finally, the King of Hatti, instead of sending messages inscribed on tablets, sent his eldest daughter, preceded by precious tribute and accompanied by Hittite nobles. Wondering what all these gifts meant, Ramses sent an Egyptian escort to meet and accompany the Hittites. And he succumbed to the beauty of the Hittite princess, made her a queen, and named her Mat-Neferu-Ra, the beauty which Ra sees. Our knowledge of history and antiquity has also profited by that love at first sight, for the pharaoh then accepted the lingering peace treaty and proceeded to inscribe it, too, at Karnak, not far from the tale of the Battle of Kadesh and the tale of the beautiful Hittite princess, had been commemorated. 2 copies, one almost complete, the other fragmentary, have been discovered, deciphered, and translated by Egyptologists. As a result, we not only have the full text of the treaty, but also know that the Hittite king wrote down the treaty in the Akkadian language, which was then, as French was a century and 2 ago, the common language of international relations. To the pharaoh, he sent a copy of the Akkadian original written on a silver tablet, which the Egyptian inscription at Karnak described thus. What is in the middle of the tablet of silver on the front side, figures consisting of an image of Seth, embracing an image of the great Prince of Hatti, surrounded by a border with the words, "The Seal of Seth, Ruler of the Sky, the seal of the regulation which Hattusilish made." What is within what which surrounds the image of the Seal of Seth on the other side? Figures consisting of a female image of the goddess of Hatti, embracing a female image of the princess of Hatti, surrounded by a border with the words, "The seal of the Ra of the town of Arena, the lord of the land." What is within the frame surrounding the figures, "The seal of Ra of Arena, the lord of every land"? In the Royal Hittite Archives, archaeologists have in fact discovered royal seals depicting the chief Hittite deity embracing the Hittite king, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 17. Exactly as described in the Egyptian record, even including the inscription surrounding the border of the seal. Against all odds, the original treaty itself, inscribed on two tablets in the Akkadian language, was also found in these archives. But the Hittite texts called their chief deity Teshub, not Seth of Hatti, since Teshub meant windy storm, and Seth, to judge, by his Greek name Typhon, meant fierce wind. It appeared that the Egyptians and Hittites were matching their pantheons according to the epithet names of their gods. In line with that, Teshub's spouse, Hebat, was called Lady of the Skies, to parallel the goddess by that title in the Egyptian version of the treaty. Ra, the Bright One, was paralleled by a Hittite Lord of the Sky, whom the Akkadian version called Shamash, the Bright One, and so on. The Egyptians and the Hittites, it became evident, were matching separate but parallel pantheons, and scholars began to wonder what other ancient treaties would reveal. One that provided surprising information was the treaty made circa 1350 BC between the Hittite king Shupilulima and Mattiwaza, king of the Hurrian kingdom of Mitanni, which was situated on the Euphrates River midway between the land of the Hittites and the ancient lands of Sumer and Akkad. Executed as usual in two copies, the treaty's original was deposited in the shrine of the god Teshub in the Hurrian city Kahat, a place and a tablet lost in the sands of time. But the duplicate tablet, deposited in the Hittite holy city of Arena, in front of the goddess of the rising disk, was discovered by archaeologists some 3,300 years after it was written. As did all treaties in those days, the one between the Hittite and Mitannian kings ended with a call upon the gods of the contracting parties to be present, to listen, and to serve as witnesses, so that adherence to the treaty shall bring divine bliss, and its violation the wrath of the gods. These gods of the contracting parties were then listed, beginning with Teshub and his consort Hebat, as the supreme reigning gods of both kingdoms. The gods who regulate kingship and queenship in Hatti and Mitanni, and in whose shrines the copies of the treaty were deposited. Then a number of younger deities, both male and female, offspring of the two reigning gods, were listed by the provincial capitals where they acted as governing deities, representing their parents. Here, then, was a listing of the very same gods in the very same hierarchical positions, unlike the Egyptian instance when different pantheons were being matched. As other discovered texts proved, the Hittite pantheon was in fact borrowed from, or through, the Hurrians. But this particular treaty held a special surprise. Toward the end of the tablet, among the divine witnesses, there were also listed Mitra-Ash, Uruwana, Indar, and the Nashtianu gods, the very Mitra, Varuna, Indra, and the Nasatya gods of the Hindu pantheon. Which of the three, Hittite, Hindu, Hurrian, was then the common source? The answer was provided in the same Hittite-Mitannian treaty. None of them. For those so-called Aryan gods were listed in the treaty together with their parents and grandparents, the olden gods, the couples Anu and Antu, Enlil and his spouse Ninlil, Ea and his wife Damkina, as well as the divine Sin, Lord of the Oath, Nergal of Cutha, the warrior god Ninurta, the warlike Ishtar. These are familiar names. They had been invoked in earlier days by Sargon of Akkad, who had claimed that he was overseer of Ishtar, anointed priest of Anu, great righteous shepherd of Enlil. His grandson, Naram-Sin, whom the god Sin loves, could attack the Cedar Mountain when the god Nergal opened the path for him. Hammurabi of Babylon marched against other lands, on the command of Anu, with Enlil advancing in front of the army. The Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser went conquering on the command of Anu and Adad and Ninurta. Shalmaneser fought with weapons provided by Nergal. Esar-Haddon was accompanied by Ishtar on his march to Nineveh. No less illuminating was the discovery that the Hittites and the Hurrians, though they pronounced the deities' names in their own language, wrote the names employing Sumerian script. Even the divine determinative used was the Sumerian Din-Gur, literally meaning the righteous ones, Din, of the rocket ship, Gur. Thus the name of Teshub was written Din-Gur-Im, divine stormer, which was the Sumerian name for the god Ishkur, also known as Adad, or it was written Din-Gur-U, meaning the god Ten, which was the numerical rank of Ishkur, Adad, that of Anu being the highest, 60, that of Enlil, 50, that of Ea, 40, and so on down the line. Also, like the Sumerian Ishkur, Adad, Teshub was depicted by the Hittites brandishing his lightning-emitting weapon, a weapon of brilliance, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 18. By the time the Hittites and their writings were reclaimed from oblivion, scholars had already determined that before the Hittite and Egyptian civilizations, before Assyria and Babylon, even before Akkad, there arose in southern Mesopotamia the high civilization of Sumer. All the others were offshoots of that first known civilization. And it is by now established beyond doubt that it was in Sumer that the tales of gods and men were first recorded. It was there that numerous texts, more numerous than can be imagined, more detailed than could be expected, were first inscribed. It was there that the written records of history and prehistory on our planet Earth had originated. We call them the Earth Chronicles. The discovery and understanding of the ancient civilizations has been a process of continuous astonishment, of incredible realizations. The monuments of antiquity, pyramids, ziggurats, vast platforms, columned ruins, carved stones, would have remained enigmas, mute evidence to bygone events, were it not for the written word. Were it not for that, the ancient monuments would have remained puzzles, their age uncertain, their creators obscure, their purpose unclear. We owe what we know to the ancient scribes, a prolific and meticulous lot, who used monuments, artifacts, foundation stones, bricks, utensils, weapons of any conceivable material, as inviting slates on which to write down names and record events. Above all, there were the clay tablets, flattened pieces of wet clay, some small enough to be held in the palm of the hand, on which the scribe deftly embossed with a stylus the symbols that formed syllables, words, and sentences. Then the tablet would be left to dry, or be kiln-dried, and a permanent record had been created, a record that has survived millennia of natural erosion and human destructiveness. In place after place, in centers of commerce or of administration, in temples and palaces, in all parts of the ancient Near East, there were both state and private archives full of such tablets. And there were also actual libraries where the tablets, tens of thousands of them, were neatly arranged by subject, their contents entitled, their scribe named, their sequel numbered. Invariably, whenever they dealt with history or science or the gods, they were identified as copies of earlier tablets, tablets in the olden language. Astounded as the archaeologists were to discover the grandeur of Assyria and Babylonia, they were even more puzzled to read in their inscriptions of olden cities. And what was the meaning of the title, King of Sumer and Akkad, that the kings of these empires coveted so much? It was only with the discovery of the records concerning Sargon of Agada that modern scholars were able to convince themselves that a great kingdom, the kingdom of Akkad, had indeed arisen in Mesopotamia half a millennium before Assyria and Babylonia were to flourish. It was with the greatest amazement that scholars read in these records that Sargon defeated Uruk and tore down its wall. Sargon, king of Agada, was victorious over the inhabitants of Ur. He defeated A-Nimar and tore down its wall and defeated its territory from Lagash as far as the sea. His weapons he washed in the sea. In the battle with the inhabitants of Uma, he was victorious. The scholars were incredulous. Could there have been urban centers, walled cities, even before Sargon of Agada, even before 2500 B.C.? As is now known, indeed, there were. These were the cities and urban centers of Sumer, the Sumer in the title King of Sumer and Akkad. It was, as a century of archaeological discoveries and scholarly research has established, the land where civilization began nearly 6,000 years ago, where suddenly and inexplicably, as though out of nowhere, there appeared a written language and literature. Kings and priests, schools and temples, doctors and astronomers, high-rise buildings, canals, docks, and ships, an intensive agriculture, an advanced metallurgy, a textile industry, trade and commerce, laws and concepts of justice and morality, cosmological theories, and tales and records of history and prehistory. In all these writings, be it long epic tales or two-line proverbs, in inscriptions mundane or divine, the same facts emerge as an unshakable tenet of the Sumerians and the peoples that followed them. In bygone days, the Dingir, the righteous ones of the rocket ships, the beings the Greeks began to call gods, had come to Earth from their own planet. They chose southern Mesopotamia to be their home away from home. They called the land Ki-En-Gur, land of the Lord of the Rockets. The Akkadian name, Shumer, meant land of the guardians. And they established there the first settlements on Earth. The statement that the first to establish settlements on Earth were astronauts from another planet was not lightly made by the Sumerians. In text after text, whenever the starting point was recalled, it was always this: 432,000 years before the deluge, the Dingir, righteous ones of the rocket ships, came down to Earth from their own planet. The Sumerians considered it a 12th member of our solar system, a system made up of the Sun in the center, the Moon, all the 9 planets we know of today, and one more large planet whose orbit lasts a sar, 3,600 Earth years. This orbit, they wrote, takes the planet to a station in the distant heavens, then brings it back to Earth's vicinity, crossing between Mars and Jupiter. It was in that position, as depicted in a 4,500-year-old Sumerian drawing, which can be found under the heading Figure 19, that the planet obtained its name Nibiru, crossing, and its symbol, the cross. The leader of the astronauts who had come to Earth from Nibiru, we know from numerous ancient texts, was called Ea, whose house is water. After he had landed and established Eridu, the first Earth station, he assumed the title Enki. A text that was discovered in the ruins of Sumer records his landing on Earth as a first-person report. When I approached Earth, there was much flooding. When I approached its green meadows, heaps and mounds were piled up at my command. I built my house in a pure place. My house, its shade stretches over the snake marsh. The text then proceeds to describe Ea's efforts to build extraordinary waterworks in the marshlands at the head of the Persian Gulf. He surveyed the marshlands, cut canals for drainage and water control, built dikes, dug ditches, and built structures of bricks molded from the local clays. He joined the Tigris and Euphrates rivers by canals, and at the edge of the marshlands he built his water house, with a wharf and other facilities.